And now we are coming to a solemn moment, one of the principal highlights of our proceedings. And this is our guest of honor. As you know, Lord Samuel, it's very difficult, really, geographically, or otherwise, to describe him. He spends 3 springs a year. One in this country, one in Israel, and one in the United States. I think March, Israel, April, New York, and May in the United Kingdom. So he's one of the lucky men, and we wish him to have many more troubled springs every year, and for many years to come. As you know, he's senior lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And next year, if I'm not betraying any secrets, he's going to celebrate the Golden Jubilee of his residence in Israel, or as formerly was Palestine and now the State of Israel. But since he is definitely going to follow the biblical tradition and reaching the span of life of Moses of 120 years, we are dealing here still, I can't call him a head boy here because I don't want any competition to our head boy we just greeted, but anyhow, a man full of youth, the French have an excellent expression, représentant de la jeunesse ardente, which expresses so much better than any other language, including Hebrew. Well, I've got to be careful with the headmaster. And so it gives me great pleasure, and I'm sure you will share with me, if I'll ask Lord Samuel to take the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for those kind remarks, and the same to Mr. Halevi. I've always been very interested in this college. I visited it in the old premises, and I was very glad to come over today from near Chichester to pinch hit, to use an Americanism, for Mr. Louis Mintz. I'd just like to supplement what your chairman said. I spend actually 7 months a year in Israel, and as he said, next year will be 50 years since I first went there. I spend a month in America, 3 months legislating now in the House of Lords, and then I have a well-earned rest in August. I thought perhaps it might be most interest to you, because speech day speeches could be an awful bore, if I were to just go over some of the points of what it's been like living in Jerusalem for nearly 50 years. I went out in 1917 as a very young artillery officer for what I think is a unique reason why anybody ever went to Palestine or Israel. I was a horse artilleryman, and I didn't want to be separated from my horses. I wanted to win the Victoria Cross galloping into action, which was impossible in France. But when I heard that Allenby was going out to Palestine with cavalry regiments, I opted to go with him. I never did win the Victoria Cross, but I stayed there 50 years, which is about the equivalent. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I first met your headmaster in Palestine, in, as he said, in those early days, and he and my wife, who was then a young girl, were neighbors, so we'd known each other a very long time. I was one of Dr. Weizmann's 4 military attaches in Tel Aviv in 1918. I, as your headmaster said, I was instrumental in helping to form one of the Jewish battalions. As you know, there were three Jewish battalions in the First World War. There was the 38th, which was raised in Whitechapel and was affectionately known in the British Army as the King's Own Schneiders. The Palestine Battalion, the 40th Royal Fusiliers, in which Ben-Gurion served, and Eshkol, and Ben-Svi, and many of the present leaders of Israel, was called not the Gordon Highlanders, but the Jordan Highlanders, while the 39th, which was the American Jewish Battalion, was said to have as a regimental motto, "No advance without security." Well, that's a pretty good military maxim, anyhow. Well, at the end of the war, I was converted to Zionism and went to Oxford. I wanted to become an electrical engineer and, in fact, had been in training for such, but there was only one disadvantage, that in Palestine there was no electricity. So that put an end to my first career. I read history at Oxford and went out as a British colonial civil servant, about the lowest form of animal life, and spent the next 28 years as an imperialist. My father was High Commissioner from 1920 to 1925. I'd arrived in 1917, and those people who think that he got me my job, I say I got him his job. Because without Allenby ably seconded by Lieutenant Edwin Samuel, there wouldn't have been a mandatory Palestine. Well, the next 5 years I spent on the staff of a very remarkable man, Sir Ronald Stawes, who said, and I think rightly, in one of his speeches, "In a sense, after Jerusalem, there is no promotion." He became governor of Cyprus, and he had a very distinguished career, but I think that is so, that Jerusalem is still, for me anyhow, the center of the universe. He also said once, as was ably said by my predecessor, Pontius Pilate, but that didn't go down quite as well. Now, life in Jerusalem in those early years, in the 1920s, I had a little house in the near the railway station, was very primitive. Not only was there no electricity, but there was no gas. We used oil lamps, which smoked. There was no central heating. We used olive wood for our stoves. There was no piped hot water in the houses, and when you wanted a bath, you had to light up a big boiler in the outhouse, and when the water was hot enough, you had pails of hot water and pails of cold water, and you mixed yourself a bath. It was quite an operation. In 1925, my father left, and before he left, of course, there was the magnificent opening of the Hebrew University on its old campus on the Mount of Olives, quite a great occasion in which Balfour came out and Allenby and Weizmann. Before that, I'd gone out with my father. I sort of very often acted as his aide-de-camp. We went over once to Transjordan. He was also High Commissioner for Transjordan, as well as being High Commissioner for Palestine. We stayed, as we often did, with the Emir Abdullah, later King Abdullah. And on one occasion, the Sharif Hussein, the man who had started the Arab rebellion, Lawrence was working for the Sharif, came himself to visit his son, the Emir Abdullah. And the other day, I found among my private papers, which I've just handed over to the Israel government, a little sketch map. King Sharif was trying to explain to my father the campaign, the revolt in the desert, and he wanted to draw a map, so I took out my little notebook, which I always carry in my pocket, with loose leaves, and tore out a leaf and gave it to the Sharif, and he drew on it a map showing the various battles that had taken place, which Lawrence describes in his book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And I kept this map, and I've just given it to the Israel government. It's the only known example of the Sharif Hussein's handwriting today in Israel. That was a very extraordinary visit to Amman. There was a tent rather like this that he put up around the palace, which was very small, and he'd invited about twice as many people that could be accommodated, and the tables were right up against the wall, and there were these enormous tables with big copper dishes with whole roasted sheep at intervals all the way down, and the waiters walked on the tables. They were Bedouin in socks, and they walked up and down, and you just held up your finger, and a man walked across the table, fetched your plate, cut you off a slice of the sheep, and handed you back your plate. That was the way in which the Arabs entertained in those days. 1925, I became a district officer in charge of the sub-district of Ramallah, now in Jordan, 60 hill villages of Arabs. It was very poor after 400 years of Turkish rule and a war in which most of the olive trees had been cut down. They were all in debt to Muslim moneylenders. I was everything. I was tax collector, I was road builder, I was school inspector, I was sanitary officer, I was chief policeman and a magistrate. I'd learnt Arabic, I had various Arab assistants. I had a Muslim assistant district officer who took bribes. I had a Muslim police officer who took bribes. I had a Muslim magistrate who took bribes. And I had a Christian Arab doctor who told me about all the others. Those of you who are interested, there's a book of short stories. I've written now four books of short stories. Well, this is the first one, called A Cottage in Galilee. It's out of print, so I can mention it. This isn't a commercial. But in there you'll find a number of stories of life among the Arabs in those days. Then I went back to Jerusalem and started the issuing of Palestine passports to Palestinians, Jews and Arabs. They were all British protected persons, and for the first time many people had a passport in their own name and, Mr. Headmaster, with the right age. In 1926 I went down to Jaffa and became responsible for the development of local government in the whole of southern Palestine, in Arab towns, in Tel Aviv, and in the German settlements. Those were the years in which Tel Aviv went bankrupt, believe it or not, and we had to help to put it on its feet. You won't believe now, but there was a time when almost everything had to be imported into Palestine. When I wanted some ink during the war, I had to get some from Egypt, because there wasn't any ink in Palestine. As a matter of fact, when I came to London at the end of the war and went to Oxford, I took some ink with me for fear I shouldn't find any in Oxford. That was my ignorance. But people's clothes all had to be made abroad, and I remember the great day, I think it was in 1926 or 1927, a man walked down the streets of Tel Aviv completely clothed with locally made garments. He had a Palestine-made shirt, he had a Palestine-made shorts, he had Palestine-made shoes, and it was so important that everybody pointed at him in the street. He had a placard, Tzeret Haaretz, locally made goods. So it's very rare, it's very comparatively recent, just under 40 years ago, since the first man in Palestine wore completely clothes completely made in the country. And now Israel, as you know, is a great exporter of textiles. Incidentally, it still exports citrus, Our major export, of course, today is polished diamonds, as you know, but citrus is very important, and I would just like here to digress and to say that there was a competition last year for a new slogan for the London buses for advertising oranges of Israel, and I put in my suggestion. I wanted to win a prize. I think it was an air trip to Israel. But anyhow, I thought it would be fun to put in a prize. They said it was too sophisticated, but my suggestion, but it was the one bright spot on a dull November morning. My suggested slogan for the London buses was Jaffa's for juice and non-juice. Well, I still think it's a good slogan. Well, in 1927, I went to the High Commissioner's office as one of his secretaries, Sir John Chancellor, and was responsible for Jewish affairs, so help me God. And it wasn't all roses. In 1929, as you remember, some of you, there were the Wailing Wall riots, in which 140 Jews were killed in different parts of the country, and an equal number of Arabs were shot, mostly by the British troops who came in to restore order. I was very much in the middle of it as a private secretary to the acting High Commissioner. And that made us realize for the first time the very deep rift there was between the Jewish population and the Arab population. I was one of the founders of a small group called Brit Shalom, the Covenant of Peace, under the leadership of Dr. Magnus, who was then Chancellor of the University, to try and bring the two sides together, but we never got very far. We now realize, of course, that the idea of Palestine as a binational state was hopeless, but still, there was still belief in those days that we might have a united Palestine. In 1930, I became Deputy Governor of Jerusalem City. I used to spend a lot of time in the old city on the Sabbath mornings, which was our day off. And one of the things I dislike most living in Jerusalem today, in Israel Jerusalem, is the inability to go across and visit the old city. Perhaps one of these days the barrier will be opened. In 1931, I went to Columbia University in America on a postgraduate course and produced my first book then, called A Primer on Palestine. And then I came back to what was, I think, the most interesting year that I ever had, and that was as governor of Galilee. Josephus was my predecessor, and I'm very glad to be able to report that I finished a road that he began. So if there's any complaints about the building of highways in England, the new throughways, remember that in Palestine there was a road that was begun 2,000 years earlier and has only now been finished. You'll find I then had 300 villages to look after, including 100 Jewish villages, all the Emek and the Kibbutzim, and I then wrote a book on the Kibbutzim of those days. You'll find in this book A Cottage in Galilee, some stories of Galilee, one in particular called Comrade Governor. In 1933 we had more riots, but this time we were prepared. I had a company of Seaforth Highlanders in Nazareth and another in Safed and 300 police. We were better equipped, and so we got out of it without any trouble. I was just at the last week, we had very heavy floods in Tiberias, which were disastrous, and 14 people were drowned, and that was quite an experience which I wouldn't wish to my worst enemy. That comes out in this book under a story called Cloudburst. I then went back to Jerusalem, and for the next 5 years I was Deputy Commissioner for Immigration, in the course of which I went all around Eastern Europe, Germany under Hitler, and Poland and Romania and Czechoslovakia trying to speed up the immigration regulations, and during the 5 years I was in that department, about 250,000 Jews came into the country legally, apart from another indefinite number that came in illegally. That, of course, led to the Arab Rebellion of 1936-38, which was a very unpleasant period. I was, as Deputy Commissioner for Immigration and Jewish, I was a double target, and for 2 years I was under heavy armed guard. That was a period when Ord Wingate was active. He was a great personal friend of mine, and a very remarkable man, almost as remarkable in his day as Colonel Lawrence, whom I also knew, had been remarkable in the First World War. Now we come to the Second World War, 1939. I was over age for active war service, so I became head of the Imperial Censorship. We had units all over the world. It was run from London. About 10,000 people were working in the censorship, enforcing the blockade of Germany, which was one of the methods adopted to bring her to her feet and to her knees. I'm sorry to say that, having signed the Secrecy Act, I'm not at liberty to tell you all the exciting things we did in unveiling enemy spy rings, etc., etc. I'm really the original Agent 007, but I won't go into that. But I will tell you that we had one rule in the censorship, and that was that our censors, most of whom were women, were never allowed, not only weren't they allowed to say what they were doing, but they were never allowed to get emotionally involved with anybody whose correspondence they were reading. For women, it was marvelous to be able to read other people's correspondence and to be paid for doing so, but that's another matter. Anyhow, there was a madman in Jerusalem. Jerusalem's full of mad people. As a matter of fact, Dr. Weizmann once said, "You don't have to be crazy to be a Zionist, but it helps." Anyhow, this man was madder than most and kept on writing letters to God. And the letters came to the censorship to be censored, to see that they were suitable for his ears, and then they went to the dead letter office, and this man kept on writing and asking God to send him £10. And about once a month he wrote this letter asking God for £10, until one of my women censors found that this was getting her down. So without telling anybody, she slipped a £5 note into an envelope and sent it to him. And as sure as anything, next week back came the letter, "Dear God, thank you so much for the £10 you sent me, only those so-and-sos in the censorship stole half of it." The last 3 years of the mandate, from 1945 to 1948, I had a delightful job. I was running the Palestine State Radio. I had my own program. I was, one time, I was teaching English by radio, and everybody was very worried. My advisors told me that nobody wanted to hear English lessons on the radio, so I started the first one by announcing, "I'm now going to give you an English grammar lesson. Please take your hand off that switch." Well, many years later, I met a German who said, "You know, a very funny thing happened. We were listening to the news, and we just kept the radio on for a few minutes after to hear what was happening, and my wife heard you say, 'I'm now going to give you a lesson on English grammar. Please take your hand off the switch.'" She was in the process of switching off, and she said, "My God, how did he know?" Well, in 1947, I was caught up again in all the fighting in Jerusalem over the end of the mandate, the United Nations decision of November 47, the siege of Jerusalem. We were then living in Talbiya, which was on the edge of the Jewish quarter facing an Arab quarter, and I had a Haganah post in my bathroom, and I used to be a British civil servant by day, and I used to be working in the Haganah at night. But it worked all right. This is one of the curious things that happened in Palestine of those days. I was blown up in the Jewish agency bomb explosion. One of my Arab friends assured me afterwards there was nothing personal about it. I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But then they did try to kidnap me, but I managed to, I think, beat the Olympic speed record. I usually carried a pistol, but that day I hadn't got it, which was very lucky, because if you don't know how to use a pistol, the first thing you do is you shoot yourself in the foot while you're trying to get it out. And then by the time you've discovered what has happened, the other man has shot you. So I didn't even wait, I just ran. And I cleared, I think, about three lines of barbed wire at something under 9 seconds for the 100 yards. But that's the fastest I've ever been, but that's why I'm here today. But in 1948, we were all evacuated from Palestine. I went out in an armored car and was flown out of the country. My wife had to be flown down to the Jordan in a Piper Cub, which was so small that it had to go back for her suitcase, because it couldn't carry both my wife. She's not so big, but she couldn't carry both my wife and the suitcase on the same trip. We then were evacuated from Lida in the middle of the fighting, and the day after, Lida Airport fell to the Arabs and remained in Arab hands until the Israel army recaptured it. And in fact, it was one of my sons who was in the Israel tank corps, very small tank corps, that actually recaptured the airport and helped to start the tank school. Well, that has given you roughly an idea of life in Palestine under the mandate, and I think that is probably as much time as you will allow me, Mr. Chairman, and so I will thank you for your attention.
Ladies and gentlemen, I did not ask Lord Samuel to carry on because he only completed up to 48 the establishment of the State of Israel. It was a moving human story. I would like to make arrangement with the headmaster. Never mind who will be in the chair, that's not important. But Lord Samuel should be invited, the guest of honor, to complete the other 18 or 19 years. Or failing that, he should have his books reprinted and not to tell us they are now out of print and therefore no longer commercial. Now, I'm sure your applause signified how we all enjoyed this great human story of a great gentleman in the Renaissance period of the Jewish people, which led to the establishment of the state. And as I said before, you see, he suffers from mania grandiosa. For me, it makes it shorter. And as I said before, we wish him many, many more years so that we can have more human stories which will benefit the young generation of today and young, the generations to come.